Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, welcome everyone to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As today, April 1st, 2021, we have a Courthouse Steps oral argument Teleforum on NCAA v. Alston. These oral arguments were heard yesterday, and it's a pretty popular case. My name is Nick Marr. I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our experts. We're very pleased this afternoon to be joined by Professor Joshua Wright. He's a university professor and executive director of the Global Antitrust Institute at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, and himself a former commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. So thank you very much for being with us today. Professor, I'll hand the floor to you.
Thanks, Nick. I thought what I would do to start is spend just a couple of minutes, especially for those on the call sort of less familiar with the sort of run-up to the case, to yesterday's argument, and then I'll share my reactions to the argument and some of my views on what's going on and what's likely to happen. But just, you know, a couple of minutes for a primer for those who maybe just sort of started paying attention to this with the argument yesterday. I suspect there aren't many of those on the call, but just in case. And there are enough NCAA cases running around that I think it probably makes sense for the conversation to distinguish one from the others. So Alston is a case about NCAA and NCAA member imposed restraints on what they describe as education-related benefits, right? So it's a challenge. You know, O'Bannon had, you know, name, image, and likeness rights. This is about restraints imposed by the NCAA on education-related benefits. How much they spend on things that they define as education-related benefits. This court talks a lot about computer equipment and books and things. And that distinction I sort of lay out in the beginning because for those of you who listen to the oral argument, there is a sort of battle over competing parades of horribles for what happens if Alston wins, what happens if the NCAA wins. Do we get into sort of pay for play and all out compensation wars for student athletes between member schools? They're sort of dancing around the line of what this means, what the decision would mean in either direction for the college athletic system generally. Like, do we end up in pay for play overall? Is that good? Is that bad? Et cetera. So one might listen to the argument and think those, you know, sort of those restraints were at issue. They are not. They're sort of a narrower set, a point that Alston's counsel made repeatedly, and I think fairly effectively throughout the oral argument. So at the district court, the court found that there might be some limited pro-competitive justification for some of the challenge restraints to the extent that they were able to preserve able to facilitate differentiation between college sports and pro sports by preventing unlimited payments that were unrelated to education, right? So the district court sort of opens this window to the idea that some of these restraints might actually be pro-competitive, that there actually may be some pro-competitive differentiating features of restraints that communicate to the marketplace that this product, college sports, is different than the alternative in the pros. But the court goes on and finds that the student athletes had successfully proven that there were less restrictive means of accomplishing those ends than the restraints actually adopted by the NCAA and rules for the plaintiffs. As a remedy, and I think there's lots of discussion of the remedy in the oral argument, and I think it is an odd one. And for the antitrust lawyers on the call, they will certainly find it to be odd. And I think you saw some back and forth with the lawyers and the justices in a conversation of what to make of the remedy. But as a remedy, the district court enjoined the NCAA from maintaining rules that cap education-related benefits, but otherwise sort of leaving the NCAA to do its own thing. The injunction from the district court allows the NCAA to write its own rules on what related to education means. It allows the individual conferences to sort of set the floor, but it allows individual conferences to sort of compete on the dimension of what education-related benefits means and impose their own more stringent caps. In doing so, it's the NCAA sort of chooses a number, and the number comes from sort of somewhere in the record on valuation sort of traditionally given to student athlete for educationally related expenses, sort of somewhere, I think it's $5,900 something, right? So about $6,000. And so that number sort of entered into the injunction. So bracket there for a moment, this should make the hair on the back of the neck of the antitrust lawyers listening in stand up a little bit. The underlying ruling says, the NCAA, so Section 1 Sherman Act case, right? So I need an agreement between competitors. I've got that. We need to find that the agreement is in restraint of trade, that it is anti-competitive. And the court says an agreement to set education-related benefits is unlawful under Section 1 of the Sherman Act, but the remedy is the setting of exactly the same. That is an odd sort of remedy in antitrust. And that struggle, I think, comes from, if you listen to the argument, you see, Justice Breyer strikes out in particular in my mind at the moment. You see some struggling with what happens in a world with no injunction at all here, or no limits, rather, on NCAA ability to impose sort of limits on compensation. If the if schools, conferences, sort of where had the unfettered ability to compete, then sort of where do we land? For folks with an antitrust background listening in, unfettered ability to compete is sort of what we do. It's what we aim for with an injunction in an antitrust case where the plaintiff has successfully demonstrated that the restraint at issue indeed violates the antitrust law. The goal of the injunction is to sort of restore the competitive outcome. It is in that light that you find the sort of injunction here, an odd antitrust animal. And I think if you listen into the oral argument on your own, or if you've done so, you see lots of sort of struggling around with what to do. I believe it was Justice Sotomayor who at some point says, well, isn't this just judicial price fixing? And Jeff Kessler responds to the question, I believe, saying, no, the NCAA picked that number. Well, the court issued the order, and the order sort of specifies a number, and sort of antitrust law, Section 1 antitrust law sort of 101 is no defense of a Section 1 case to say that horizontal competitors have selected a reasonable price. That's not what we do in antitrust law. We force rather than cooperating together to suppress competition, we force those institutions to compete. And that's sort of not what the remedy does. And so you've got some issues that arise in oral argument, and I'll return to those, but I just sort of wanted to highlight a little bit the remedy. Ninth Circuit reviews the trial record and unanimously affirms the district court's finding and its injunction. It concludes in sort of the second step of the rule of reason framework, says that step one, the student athletes have successfully satisfied the initial burden of showing an anti-competitive effect. No surprise that sort of NCAA sort of proudly says we've defined our product to suppress wages. And in step two, says the district court did just fine, right? It credited the NCAA's argument that some restraints are necessary to facilitate demand for what the NCAA at least describes as this differentiated product. It says, sure, if true, and you have imposed restraints that facilitate demand, if factually true, that's okay. You can make those arguments. Those are cognizable arguments under the antitrust law. You've got to prove them up factually. And you have for some, you haven't for others. And so it sort of says in step two, some of the challenge rules serve a pro-competitive purpose, but the limits on non-cash education-related benefits do not. So we end up in that setting, sort of coming to the Supreme Court, and the oral arguments, which were one of my favorites to listen to out of the sort of recent set, because I think you've got, as sometimes happens in the sports cases, you get you know, sports antitrust is sometimes a different animal, and occasionally you get you know, unique tensions between the ways people feel about markets and products and sort of how they run into Section 1 doctrine. And I think you see a little bit of that here. Let me give a couple of my own observations about what I heard and how I sort of see the case and see things in light of the oral argument, and highlight a couple of things that I thought were interesting. So I view the case largely, and I think both sides in the oral argument sort of embrace this view, at least in parts, although they may characterize it differently, as about the boundaries of the limits of antitrust law in reaching product design decisions for firms. This is a big, important area of antitrust law, and somebody described, I'm forgetting which justice I believe it was Waxman. So they said, well, the received antitrust wisdom is courts don't second guess and Monday morning quarterback, I guess that's not college sports, but Monday morning quarterback product design decisions. We review restraints after the fact. We maybe even review mergers after the fact, but we don't do that with product design decisions. That's sort of there's a special place in antitrust law, and it's true. I can cite you cases sort of from now until the end of the call where courts have said, hey, product design is special, and we really don't want Article III courts micromanaging and second-guessing product design decisions. And the NCAA grasps on to that concept in those cases and structures its defense around it, right? That is a principle that exists somewhere in antitrust doctrine. And they grab onto it and they say, sort of primarily as their defense, we have made what we pay our workers a feature of product design. Now, here's where I think you get into what I view as the primary problem for the NCAA's argument and the primary flaw in the NCAA's argument, which ultimately I think will lead it to lose here. And we can have fun talking about vote counts later. But I think they lose here for the following reason. Let me sort of break this into two different observations and tie them to the oral argument. One of the observations is that the place where that product design principle lives in antitrust law are largely Section 2 cases. They're largely monopolization cases. There are cases about what a single firm does to design its product. It is really difficult to win an antitrust case alleging that a single firm, even one with monopoly power, has designed the way in a product in a way that you don't like, right? So, you know, you'll see this with respect to, there were investigations. The FTC closed investigations in Google search back in 2015. There are about, you know, the order of search results, right? There is a robust, longstanding principle that a single firm gets to design the product the way it wants. If it doesn't want it to be interoperable, if it doesn't want it, if they don't want to sell to a rival, right? Refusal to deal law. Within the bounds of antitrust law, plaintiffs can win, right? But it is rather difficult, and courts are sort of reluctant to redesign the product and say, hey, listen, firm that has been successful, with a product for which there is consumer demand, let's sort of second guess and go in and say you should have designed it differently. Problem is, this is not a monopolization case. This is a case where instead the NCAA finds itself not making an argument like Google and search, you know, we design the product the way we like. The argument they are making is that they got together with the NCAA as a collection of competitors that got together and said, we are going to make a product for which the core feature is an agreement between rivals to suppress wages below the competitive level. Right? That, I think, is different in kind, not just degree, from the type of product design cases from which the sort of deferential principle in antitrust law was birthed. It is quite different. And what they've done is they've said the core product design feature of amateurism is not just low wages. It is an agreement between competitors, an agreement that would otherwise be a Section 1 violation, and maybe, and Jeff Kessler leads with this point. He says, any other context, this would be a per se antitrust violation. Maybe a felony, right? Maybe pursued criminally. Okay? But it's been treated here historically for different reasons. And so, look, we'll sort of live with the rule of reason, but let's not make any qualms about the fact that this is an agreement between rivals that otherwise would probably be per se unlawful. We lived with the rule of reason. We won under the rule of reason factually, right? The lower court said, hey, NCAA, if you can prove up that these restraints actually improve competition, you can have some of them. But they lost on this one, and sort of so here we are. So I do think that clinging to the product design defense, right? The defense that we allow firms leeway in antitrust law to design their products and go compete. And it's a defense that's been successful in a lot of settings. Again, primarily monopolization law settings where the plaintiff is a rival or a customer who would like the product designed differently in some way. This is quite different. This is a distinction where the NCAA, I think creatively, but I think ultimately unsuccessfully, is playing a little bit fast and loose, maybe a lot fast and loose, with that product design principle to say, it is an agreement between rivals that would otherwise violate the antitrust laws. That is the core product design feature. That leads into a whole bunch of other arguments, but I wanted to sort of begin with highlighting the limits of that principle as it exists sort of currently in the doctrine. There are other attempts to sort of grapple with that principle. And I largely read a lot of the oral argument kind of sort of through the lens of trying to grapple with the NCAA's attempt to do something creative with that principle. So, for example, Justice Gorsuch starts with and returns to the idea of monopsony power in his questions, right? He says, well, wait a minute, isn't what's different here? He sort of goes to joint venture law, where this product design principle sort of exists, right? He goes to joint venture law and he says, well, if we need the joint venture to have a product exist, we sort of let people design the venture how they want. But isn't this different? Because he attempts to distinguish through the presence of monopsony power. He says, well, but they've got monopsony power, and so isn't that different? Where we have joint ventures and there's not market power. Well, that product design principle is fine and great and pro-competitive and consistent with the purposes of the antitrust laws. But isn't monopsony power what makes it different? And I think that's 75% of the way there. The next question to ask, and others get at this in particular, I particularly enjoyed Justice Kagan's line of questioning, and Justice Kavanaugh as well. The reason why Justice Gorsuch is worried about monopsony power here is because there is an agreement between competitors, right? The source of the monopsony power is an agreement between competitors to suppress wages. It seemed like in that agreement, let me make sort of two points about that. Justice Thomas was attracted to sort of this line of thinking with Justice Gorsuch. He started by asking, hey, what happened? What about the coaches? You've said the core product design feature is an agreement to suppress wages, but why does that only apply to the players? What happened to coaches' salaries? And, you know, sort of knowing darn well that they had ballooned. Okay. And, you know, Waxman answers at some point to say, well, yeah, that's right. If we don't have the restraints, look what happened to coaches' salaries. Salaries will balloon and the sky will fall because, you know, that's going to turn these people, these student athletes into professionals, and they're going to spend, you know, even less time studying, or sort of parade of horribles sort of goes there. For my antitrust lawyers that are listening, sort of try to do that argument in a non-sports context, right? Or even a non-labor market context. It's essentially an argument by the defendant in a Section 1 case that said, yes, you're darn right, our agreement suppresses wages. We know this because in areas where we did not suppress wages, wages were not suppressed. This is not something you would be committing malpractice as the defendant in a Section 1 argument, making that argument in another context. I'm certainly not suggesting it was a poor argument for the NCAA to make, because sort of sports antitrust laws operated so differently, and it is the concept of amateurism and the way that the court has clung to it in earlier cases that sort of opens this line of defense and makes it plausible. In my view, plausible and ultimately unconvincing and unpersuasive, but that's where that line of questions comes from. But you have sort of right there on the sleeve of the defendant sort of wearing the patches that say, yes, you know, yes, our restraint suppresses wages. And that's good. Well, the problem is the rest of antitrust law says that's not good, right? And so there's this struggle of whether amateurism or the ideal of college sports sort of enough to turn that part of antitrust law on its head. You see some element of that discussion in the questions that come from Justices Kavanaugh and Kagan, who I think both very directly and in fairly pointed language, I mean, Justice Kavanaugh says, sort of invokes a concept that lies in a lot of Supreme Court doctrine post-1980s that say we do substance over form. We're not going to allow the antitrust laws to sort of give cover to a cartel agreement to exploit workers. And what he means there is using the cloak of amateurism or the label of amateurism might get you something given the past cases, but it doesn't get you a different set of antitrust rules. And a horizontal conspiracy to suppress wages is and would otherwise be a violation of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. Justice Kagan, I think, led that line of questioning, and I thought it was the highlight of the oral argument for what it's worth. Justice Kagan sort of hit the $64,000 question right off the bat. She sort of gives a long speech about, well, not long, 20 seconds, about goodness, counsel for the NCAA. You make this amateurism stuff sound fairly high-minded, but what if I don't care about the history here? Isn't this just, or what amateurism used to be? And, you know, it's different. You're paying coaches with the, we talked about the strength coaches making $700,000 or some. Isn't it different now? But more importantly, isn't this just an agreement between rivals to suppress wages at its core? And I think that sort of where the rubber hits the road line of questions from Justices Kavanaugh and Kagan are really sort of what the case is about. My own view is, under standard antitrust principles, the answer is yes, it's plainly a Section 1 violation. And will the justices sort of take the invitation to say, but amateurism is different? And this is, you know, been the classic struggle in Section 1 NCAA related cases for a really long time, which both gives the justices sort of prior decisions and rules of the road to grapple with. But I also think gives plenty of room to write a decision that both respects conceptually that the NCAA has the right and ability to have a differentiated product from pro sports. It can set all kinds of rules. But what it's not allowed to do is what everybody else isn't allowed to do under Section 1, which is agree with competitors to fix prices, including the price of labor. One last point that I think I will, I'd like to highlight because I thought it's sort of fascinating. You get all sorts of defenses in sports cases generally, but with the NCAA specifically, that you really don't see in other areas. And I thought one other really fascinating area of questioning to highlight, and I thought Amy Coney Barrett's questioning on this in particular, and Justice Sotomayor as well, and I think a little bit from Justice Kagan, touched on the issue of, and I'm going to return to this product design point, on the point of who gets to decide what amateurism is. And so, sort of going back a step, you know, I sort of just finished saying that, you know, if, unless you think amateurism is sort of really special in some way where it turns some basic antitrust principles on its head, I think this is a sort of pretty, I hesitate to word to use easy, so to use the word easy, it's a pretty straightforward case for the plaintiffs. But you can see some sort of, you know, minds open, and we, you know, on the idea that maybe amateurism is that different or that special. And so we have this line of question about, well, what that means and what that would look like. And I think one of the really interesting aspects of the oral argument, and sort of one I'll highlight in case anybody's interested in talking about it, And the questions is the sort of who decides part. And I found the NCAA's argument a little bit troubling in this regard. So the argument, in antitrust 101, when we think about how we adjudicate restraints of trade under the rule of reason, right? The standard is whether they sort of the Chicago board kind of seminal standard is whether they ultimately suppress or promote competition. And we have ways to think about that through economic analysis. Do they increase consumer welfare? Does output go up? Right? Does the quality go up? Right? Are consumers made sort of better off? And the NCAA sort of says, we know that the restraints are pro-competitive because the product exists and has existed for a long time. And it's a little bit of a moving of the goalpost, right? The case is about the particular restraint, right? Whether the particular restraints promote or suppress competition. The defense is our whole product is on net good, right? And there's a little bit of a misconnect that, in a different type of antitrust case, I think you would sort of jump on right away. We're adjudicating the effect of the restraint, not of the sort of product as a whole. And the NCAA's move is, well, we need some restraints to have the product as a whole. But what about this one, right? And this is where this move comes in. Well, they say, our product is amateur sports, and we've defined amateur to mean we get to suppress the wages to a level that we feel is consistent with our definition of amateur. The problem is that it's not a contract interpretation case where firms get to sort of commit to their own lexicon and judges defer. It's not a contract interpretation case. It's a case about interpreting the Sherman Act. And the Sherman Act sets a backdrop of rules that tell us how to evaluate the restraints that frankly don't really care about if the NCAA feels like has strong feelings about what the word amateurism means or how they define it. This are sort of core principles for evaluating agreements are whether they suppress or promote competition. If I went in any other market and I said, I would like to compete in the athletic shoe market, and the way I would like to do that is I am going to conspire with other shoemakers to keep the price of labor down. And we will, because of that, be able to sell our shoes more cheaply or make more shoes or better shoes. Or maybe there's just a bunch of consumers who like buying shoes knowing they were made with cheap labor. Be a silly argument to make in that case, right? Consumers want the wages suppressed. I think that probably just isn't true factually. But just sort of thinking about it as a legal concept without regard to whether it's factually true, which I doubt, what we would say in the normal context is, what you've done is committed a Section 1 violation. You can't compete that way. Right? Antitrust places all sorts of limits on the way that you compete. And some of those limits are sort of gray and fuzzy. This one is not. This one is you cannot agree with your competitors to fix prices in order to compete more effectively in a market. That's not something you can do. It's sort of a long standing principle. I think about cases, sort of way outside of the antitrust context. Think the DOJ brought a case against Apple, and this was its ebook case. And the defense was in large part, hey, we Apple was alleged to be the sort of hub and a hub and spoke conspiracy between publishers. And the defense was something along the lines of, we need the agreement between publishers to solve a collective action problem. If all the publishers will come on with Apple and adopt our model, we'll be able to compete with Amazon and the selling of books. We're worried Amazon is charging prices that are too low, and the publishers are worried that this is bad, and so they enter into a conspiracy with Apple as the hub, and they say this is to make us compete more effectively against Apple, and they lose. They lose in a relatively straightforward way, in large part because the sort of plain and simple limit in antitrust that any of the publishers could have agreed individually to work with Apple. But what you can't do is enter into agreements with competitors to fix prices or output or business models to claim you more effectively compete elsewhere. I think that this runs into sort of that bedrock principle. I think you will see the justices struggle with the appeal to amateurism. I mean, Justice Breyer in particular sort of stands out as, but the product is really special. He says at some point, I think you will find sort of attempts to struggle. And if the violation of the antitrust laws here were not so plain, I think it would be a much tougher case. But this is at its core something that is, was, and has been a sort of plain vanilla hornbook violation of the antitrust laws for a long time. The attempts to get around that concept by making it a product design case, I think, are incredibly creative, but ultimately fail to persuade me, and my guesses from the line of questioning will fail to to convince more than maybe one or two justices that there's anything else going on here other than an attempt to sort of dress up or disguise an agreement that would otherwise violate Section 1 of the antitrust laws as an element of product design. I don't think that the antitrust laws and the modern cases interpreting Section 1 or the rest of the antitrust laws, for that matter, sort of embrace the principle that the core substance of Section 1 can be avoided in that way. I'll stop there. A bunch of other stuff I wrote down, but I talked longer than I thought I would. So I will stop there and happy to talk, answer questions, or hear what you think.
Thanks very much, Professor, for that great overview. We've got a caller queued up already.
Thank you. I was wondering whether any of the briefing at any stage of the case addressed the issue of amateurism's long and very sordid history. It has been used, especially a long time ago, both in the United States intercollegiately and in the Olympics and places like that, to, for example, keep out poor folks and especially non-white folks as competitors. I found the differentiated product based on amateurism to not only be silly for the reasons that you pointed out, but also to be basing it on something that is really, in many ways, very distasteful when examined more carefully.
It's a great question. I know, I never get that, a 10-day trial in this thing, and I'm not sure whether any of that evidence, and I think your description of the history is an accurate and fair one, made it into this record. I know it has made it into the record of the other NCAA, you know, Bannon and the like. So I would be surprised if it were not somewhere in the record here. And, you know, I found Justice Kagan's reaction to some of the the sort of historical arguments to be. Certainly the one that I was most sympathetic to, which was, look, the history is largely when the NCAA invoked the history, it is for the point, at least in the oral argument, it was invoking the history for the point that the product has been on the market, the product sort of survived the market test. Mr. Waxman sort of kept saying, we know it's competitive because the product exists and has existed for a long time. And I think that was, it was a little too slick for my tastes, in the sense that it evaded the question of, you know, that consumers value a product is different from saying that this restraint is pro-competitive. Those sort of are different things. And Justice Kagan's approach was, well, forget your history. And I do think, and I think she makes an allusion to this in the argument, she sort of, I do think she made a reference to the, you know, the history can cut both ways or can cut the other way as well. And I'm not sure if that was a reference to the part of the history that you're talking about. So the punchline is, I'm not sure if that was in the record with respect to these restraints, but it certainly has been in the backdrop of all of the policy discussion around this, but also I think in previous litigation.
Thank you. Could I ask a quick second question? Shorter one?
I don't make the rules. Go for it.
Why do you think the court took the case, since athletes are gradually starting to win them now? I haven't followed it close to know whether or not there's a split in the circuits or not. Is it perhaps because the court wants a more, either to advance the process significantly or because it wants a more black and white and more satisfying solution, like eliminating all the limits?
So it's a good question. I'll give you my guess, and you know, that and $5 gets you a cup of coffee, but I'll tell you anyway. What I was listening for was during the argument was a third possibility. And as a, you know, an antitrust academic who has a case book and teaches this stuff, it was the one I was kind of hoping for, was that you had a Supreme Court interested in cleaning up some of the underlying Section 1 doctrine, the sort of, you know, rule of reason framework and burden shifting and what on, you know, the less restrictive alternatives cases, if you read them, are a dead awful mess, and they play a big role here. So I was sort of hopeful and listening for some desire to do that. I heard none of it. And so I'm sort of left with a similar, but a smaller set of possibilities. And I think here, one idea at least, is that the likelihood that you get a split in the, you know, you now will have a suit over, you know, every restraint ever and every change of rules from the NCAA, you know, the suits are going to keep coming. You know, an NCAA is going to be found to have an agreement in violation of Section 1, and we're going to have a bunch of injunctions doing a bunch of different things. So I think the idea that you have sort of an unholy mess anticipated in the lower court decisions certainly played some role in why I would want to take the case if I were a member of the Supreme Court. Sort of not not that you have a sort of plain split yet, because the student athletes are starting to win. You know, it gives them a chance to revisit Board of Regents. I was hopeful that chance would sort of open the door to some more general Section 1 cleanup. Like I said, I just didn't hear any of that. But my best guess is, like you said, the plaintiffs are winning these, and they'll continue to be more. And I do think that opens the door to, you know, a situation where, you know, clearly a lot of, you know, the justices are sort of, we're projecting the, you know, we care about you know, the product is special and all of that. And maybe you want to fast forward to the end game a little faster here. And that reminds me of the in the oral argument you had. I did find it odd. You had justices really interested. I mean, they used the phrase antitrust end game. I'm going to now have to write a paper with that title. I don't know what it'll be about yet. But they did this antitrust endgame. Is it going to Congress? Are we going to lots of things outside of the meets and bounds of the question presented about what was going to end up happening? Probably a third of the argument was either parade of horribles on either side about implications. And, you know, that happens in these arguments. But a lot of, are you going to sue again? What are you going to sue again about? If the comp raises from 59 to 8,000, if there's a new survey, are you going to sue again? What's going to happen in Congress? So, you know, my best guess that's at least consistent or, you know, colorable because it's consistent with the existing evidence is something like anticipated holding mess and maybe a split, who knows, but sort of fast forwarding the end game.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll go to our next caller now.
Hello, Professor. This is John Fortin, one of your former students at George Mason. It's somewhat along the same lines as the follow-up question, and I'm actually going to ask you to engage with it fully. If I'm listening to your description and idea of the court's holding, you kind of think that the court is not going to completely overturn the NCAA versus Oklahoma holding with regards to amateurism. And if that's right, are you thinking that, you know, NCAA versus Oklahoma and the BMI cases are your two kind of seminal, really good defense cases for rule of reason analysis? I've created something new with amateurism and with the catalog of songs under the BMI case. Are you thinking that there's chinks in the armor in this with this case and that, that this kind of line of reasoning is going to finally fall. And it's just, we're not going to carve out exceptions, I think is really the best way to ask the question.
That's a great question, John, and good to hear from you. So I don't think they're going to overturn BMI or NCAA. I don't think any of that is going to happen. I think the best way to read my sort of skepticism of the NCAA arguments on that front is skepticism about the claim that the restraints, I mean, sort of divided into two pieces, that it is factually true that the restraints are necessary to have the product. I think the line of cases that say, if you enter into some restraints that facilitate creation of a new product, that to facilitate entry, that is an antitrust good. I think that line of cases is safe and secure and not going anywhere. What you have here is an attempt to say that a particular restraint is necessary to create the product. I think the right question. I think you're hearing from me skepticism that claim is factually true. And in fact, they lost on the facts. In the lower courts on that claim, but the legal sort of avenue for defendants in Section 1 cases to say the restraint is reasonably necessary to the creation of a new product, I think that's sort of safe and sound. I do think what this adds is closer to, there's lots of talk about the case, you know, with Board of Regents and BMI for good reason. I think in some ways the case is much closer to Professional Society of Engineers in the sort of Section 1 canon, in the sense that case sets, you know, in Professional Society of Engineers to say it's a per se violation for, you know, you have a joint venture, a society of engineers that sets an ethical code for its members, and the ethical code for its members says, restricts the ability to compete. And, you know, sanctions them for competing. And the defense was, yeah, but goodness, if engineers compete on price, then, you know, quality is going to fall and buildings are going to fall on heads. And the court says, stop that. That's not what we do in antitrust law. The antitrust laws are built on the premise that competition is good, and it's just not cognizable. You are not allowed to stand up in court as an antitrust defense and say competition is bad. My reading of this case is closer to that, right? My reading is what where the court is going is not that NCAA, not the Board of Regents or BMI, those defenses are available to defendants, but what's off the board is the argument that the restraint is necessary to create the product only because I've defined the product to be something that requires an agreement to suppress wages. That is a sort of a circular dance that says the design of my product requires a felony. And so it's not a felony when I do it because I define the product that way. I think that's off the table. And to me, that's the easiest way to write this. I mean, the easy way to write this is as an extension of professional engineers. I don't think because of the history here, go ahead.
That was really going to be the follow-up question since the last caller got to ask a follow-up was so the still joint venture prong of we like synergies in industry, but we don't like when that synergy excludes. And I think that's really what you're saying you think the holding's going to be, which I think is the correct answer, or it should be the correct answer, but what do I know? And thank you very much for answering the question.
Yep, my pleasure. Okay, thank you very much for that question, caller. We don't have any questions in the queue right now, but in the meantime, Professor, I'll send it back to you if you want to touch on anything you didn't get to touch on, or if you want to close this afternoon.
I'm happy to close if there are no other questions. I think it'll be really interesting. I do think, like I told the last caller, the easiest way to do this is to say, to the extent that it is true that amateurism promotes consumer demand and consumer welfare, you can make arguments under the antitrust laws, a la Board of Regents. You can certainly make arguments that amateurism promotes consumer welfare. The arguments have to be true, right? They have to be true, and you can go and you can have fights over the evidence over whether the restraints promote or suppress competition. And to the extent it is true that amateurism helps successfully differentiate the product from some other product and consumers benefit from that competition, that's something that's cognizable under the antitrust laws. It was yesterday. It is today. You can do that. And we'll have fights about that over the merits. That's fine. That leaves Board of Regents intact. It's not an attack on amateurism, et cetera. I think all of that stays. I think what goes, and the easiest way to write it, and you give that to the, you know, to Justice Breyer and others who want to make sure we're sort of not eating amateurism in the opinion. But you say those defenses, one, have to be true. They weren't in the court underneath, right? They were at least, that was what the record. And two, we take off the table that what's allowed is to say the product feature that the restraint facilitates, right? The one I'm pointing to as sort of pro-competitive is defined by a conspiracy that would otherwise violate the antitrust laws. If I started selling my tennis shoes on the basis that they were built on the back of an antitrust violation, I said, look, it's a crazy market. People like all kinds of weird stuff. And maybe people like to know I was breaking the law to make the shoes, right? So I tell them I have entered into Section 1 conspiracies to make these shoes. And that is true. And people buy the shoes because of that, right? I would expect to lose my antitrust case. And I think that's, and you know, a caricature of an example. But I think that that ultimately is what you've got going here. The antitrust laws do not contemplate or allow, so far as I read them, an antitrust defendant in a Section 1 case to say, look, I've got this neat product characteristic. The neat product characteristic is the violation of the law, but because I successfully sell the product, antitrust analysis of the restraint changes. I just don't think that that's a proposition of law. I think in a normal case that wasn't about college athletics, it's a 9-0 opinion and it's a slam dunk. I think, you know, we're not writing on a blank slate. So I think you may get a couple of different opinions, but I think you'll get overwhelming agreement on the fact that you've got a Section 1 violation, that you'll get Board of Regents intact, and that largely the thrust of the opinion will be about the non-cognizability of arguments that you can define the product feature as a violation of the law.
All righty, Will, thanks very much, Professor. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to offer our sincere thanks for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. That was a great program, very thorough, and I'm sure our audience will walk away knowing a lot more about this. And thank you also to our audience for calling in for your great questions. Just as a reminder, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Also be checking your emails for announcements about upcoming telephone calls. They're also listed on our website. So we'll have more of these oral argument coverages. There are a couple of cases that the Supreme Court ruled on this morning. We'll have those scheduled hopefully in the next week. So check back in for more information about those. But until next time, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.